With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Time for our, I think it's fair to say, first major political interview since RCR has been back on air. And if my memory serves me, and it's getting a little dodgy these days, it's the second time that we've spoken now, or will be in just a moment, with the leader of New Zealand First, the Deputy Prime Minister, and the Foreign Minister, Winston Peters. Winston, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to see you guys back.
Thank you. And can I personally thank you for receiving the People's Terms of Parliament? That was great.
Yes, well, it was a very important petition, underscoring the kind of information that is now coming out of countries overseas about the purpose of that petition, which was to have a proper inquiry with proper terms of reference, with the right people doing the job professionally, upon which both Parliament and the public can rely at the end of this inquiry.
I thought I was, once again, thankfully, watching kind of democracy in action. You know, where you come with the goods, right? And yeah, and the goods are received.
Well, most definitely. And the point was, you know, in a speech on the 30th of July last year in Whangarei, we set out what had needed to be done because we looked at the terms of reference. They were totally inadequate and then came to the conclusion, well, no commissioners would accept those terms of reference knowing their inadequacy. So the whole thing, in my view, was suspect and we needed to do it properly in the way that that evidence is emerging in places like Australia and England.
AstraZeneca being an example. But we had Pfizer here. I've noticed that Wednesday just gone that Kate McNamara did an opinion piece in the New Zealand Herald, headed up Tony Blakely's advice to government and what it means for the inquiry he chairs. First of all, it's a mainstream media opinion piece. That's number one. Second, she goes through and lists all the associations this man had with professional scientific colleagues, who many of them were involved in the government response. He was deep in our government's response. Lockdowns, MIQ, the elimination strategy, which all looks a bit crazy and, well, that's the word I'd use now. It seems this is now sort of oozing out, starting to ooze out now.
Well, I congratulate her for that article and also for the Herald to run it. But why did we have to wait so long when the rightful suspicion about the podium of truth was something that we should have inherited as a sound democracy? Because no one in that sort of science could ever make that claim, and yet they were making it. And anybody that didn't believe it was gaslit out of the conversation, described as being down a rabbit hole and mandated out of work. Just so wrong.
Conflicts of interest alarm people. This is like a world, a universe of conflicts of interest. How could it ever have got by anyone to a decision to appoint this man and there's the other commissioner and we want a change of those commissioners? With all your experience, how does that happen?
It happens because the purpose of the inquiry was never to get at the truth, but to cover the then government's bottom, so to speak, from a proper inquiry. The moment I saw the terms of reference, I realised how defective this would be and it could not be relied upon. Now, I wasn't part of the political system in that time, but it was so glaringly obvious that they did not want to get at the truth. And even if I was one of those people there as a proposed commissioner, I'd be seriously asking myself, can I say that I'm neutral, unbiased, given my record on this matter? Now, we shouldn't have to ask those questions. They should have been answered themselves.
I want to ask you about this before we move on to other things. We had, of course, people at Parliament. They were up in the public gallery, right down at the bottom level, looking over on the opposition side. And they noticed that, and I think this is question time's compulsory, right? You've got to be there for the hour. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And they were looking at people who were mucking around on phones, playing Candy Crush. Another looking at haircuts, others messaging on Signal and other apps, scrolling through Facebook news sites, and didn't seem to be engaged with what was actually happening. I'm just wondering, after hearing that, I thought I'd ask you, as taxpayers, it kind of feels wrong, doesn't it, that they'll be messing about with the public looking on, the highly paid. We should expect better than that, shouldn't we? We want to know that people are paying attention.
Look, the reality is that is a fair expectation, but in many parliamentary circumstances, specific people are dedicated to lead that in Parliament. And so they are the ones that should be watching, because if you're going to have to dedicate every minute and every hour while they're sitting in Parliament, listen to all the debates, even when you've got specialists in your caucus who are doing that, then you won't get any work done. A lot of people go to Parliament with a whole lot of correspondence to be part of the system, so to speak, or be available for help if they're required. But you should be, if you're on the phone, you should be on the phone doing your business.
So that's where it crosses the line.
Yeah, that's where it crosses the line. If you're there, you're some sort of amusement parlour, and the public see that, or as they saw on an overseas occasion recently where this MP was actually looking at porn, this is a shocker.
That line on who is a woman in Parliament, well, last week, is that something that comes off the top of your head, or were you waiting for that?
Well, he gets up and he's talking about pay equity, the rights of women. And I'm thinking to myself, excuse me, when you were asked last year what a woman was, you couldn't tell us. And this is appalling. I'm just saying, are you sincere about this issue, or are you just posing? And that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, well, momentarily it was a showstopper.
Well, it's so simple, you know, male.
Yeah, I get it. Don't worry.
Human, adult, but a female, human, adult, they're two different people. But no, he couldn't say. And that's why I put it up on my social media to show what a farce this is.
Is there a pay equity, gender pay equity issue, really? I mean, it's very debatable, isn't it?
Yeah, no, yes, there is. But how do you get there? That's the point. And you've got a lot of circumstances which we need to look into. But if you go out and just assert that all these jobs are the same because men and women are in them, well, it's not quite the way it is. What I'm concerned about, and what we're concerned about, is to ensure that two people of different gender doing the same job get the same pay. But this is not what's happening here. It's being misused to try and get out different outcomes. And as a consequence, it needs to be looked at seriously, because in the end, pay equity is a fair demand, but how do we get there properly? It requires a lot of investigation and a lot of talk. In fact, last night at 11:30, I was having that debate with people on that very issue, who are some of them are extraordinary bright, and there was differences of opinion. But what we were trying to say, without being complicated, is can we possibly get a criteria that we can all agree on, then we'll get to the outcome. But if you don't agree with the criteria, then we're going to spend all that time debating it.
Okay. All right. I want to talk about energy. I think in a couple of chats ago, we kind of touched on social housing and how come we were able to build 78,000 houses in 1930, whenever it was, with population fraction or a good deal smaller than the size that we have now. But along with that too, we also built all our own electricity generating systems. And I remember having the Conway heater on at home, mum and dad, cranking, you know, probably sucking huge amounts of watts, everyone in the street. You know, those were the days. What the hell has happened?
Well, we lost our mojo. You know, I was going back to talking to some of my colleagues and said, is it 1870 to 1880? And in that time, they built more railways with that ancient equipment and workforce in 10 years than we did for the next 130 years. It's whether you set out to build proper infrastructure and make it efficient and make it cost respectable. That's what we had to do, and we just have lost the plot, and we didn't make the investment, and that's why we've got having all these rows now. And worse than that, the previous government was shutting down any chance to expand our energy efficiency.
But it impacts the people. It kind of feels third world, and then importing coal from somewhere else. We've got all this gas. I mean, what are we doing to ourselves?
Well, we were heading to be the sixth most energy efficient country in the world, developed country in the world, and very quickly. But what happened was, you've got people who want the new world, but are absolutely anti the critical component of that new world, which is extraction. We can't build any of these efficient things going forward unless we engage in mining. So they want all the change, but are anti-mining. This is mad. You have got to acknowledge, as you do in Scandinavia, and there's Nordic countries, they're very environmentally focused, far more than we are, but they do believe in using the resources that we've got. And here we are importing inferior Indonesian coal to placate our conscience whilst we're not using our own. This is, again, hypocrisy.
Coal compared to gas. Gas wins every time, right? Well, so we're still prepared to dirty up the atmosphere. We talk the talk. There's no walking the walk, really, is there?
Yeah, but we're in a transition period. Before we jump to a transition period, you hear a lot of debates going on, and all these highfalutin, multi-vowel words in these sort of sandwiches of conversation. And yet, when you say to them, so where's the infrastructure to, and when will it be ready for that to be a case? And they say, oh, 15, 20, 25 years. You see what I mean? So why are you holding up what you can, what you want to do as an option when you know you can't deliver it? And so let's expect and respect that we are in a transition and we cannot afford what you've seen in some other countries. The lights going down, business are being stopped in a country that has got the resources.
Yeah. Is there a plan to bring a capability back up to whatever it should be? Is there a plan?
There is a plan, and it includes, using our resources to develop the alternatives as fast as we can. But having said that, something, a lot of electricity in this country is wasted. I see people who leave the bathroom, and this is in offices, in around Parliament, and they leave the bathroom or the toilet lights on all day. Now, surely you can switch the darn thing off when you leave. And I would think that I once did an exercise in my own office years ago. I got some experts in, and they said, you're using electricity probably 85% more than's required just because you want to have the lights on. And if you're not in the room and you're not there, well, turn the things off. And I think that asking the public to do that is not saying you'll have less electricity or less heating, but you won't be wasting electricity. The first study that was first done was when someone noticed that they were flying over this country and most of the lighting was lighting the sky, not the streets. So they just turned that around, using about a quarter of the resource. They're still lighting the streets, but not the sky. Or as my father used to say when he came home when we were young, Taos looks like a ship at sea. Turn the lights off.
People think it's a UFO. Remember Kaikoura?
Yes.
And ironically, you might want to make a comment on this, it was, I think, a lack of solar and wind power that was causing the degrading of the system capability. So that's ironic.
Well, solar and wind and all those things all have a place, but you cannot afford to have when those utilities are not shining and it's not blowing. You cannot afford to have blackouts, not in our modern economy. And that's why first hint of a serious coal snap alerted us to the fact, so what have we got available? Because there'll be more power being used. And a realistic assessment and warning the public was what was required, not what I have seen in the past where up in Auckland the whole place shut down because the cables had been not maintained properly. It was frightening. That was a long time ago now.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a huge deal.
Unbelievable. And then, Cyclone Gabriel, we understood. We're running around trying to get generators, just trying to keep the fridge so that normal food didn't go rotten. That was understandable because we couldn't handle that crisis, an act of God almost. But this is a crisis we could and should handle.
So before we get on to foreign affairs, where was the brain fart, the lack of foresight, the previous administration did they put us in this position? Did they do it?
Yes, they went down to New Plymouth and made an announcement, and you'll see a photograph. They made an announcement, and I was there, but behind them was Shane Jones, and he had his hand over his face. He couldn't believe what he was hearing because they had just jumped way ahead of themselves and were talking about green hydrogen and everything else. And the question is, can you possibly tell New Zealanders when you're going to have this ready to go? When you'll have the utilities up and running so they can use it? Because they didn't have an answer, but they were still saying it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Those think big projects, well, you could argue and debate those, but some of what came out of that served the country quite well. Am I right?
Oh, look, they served the country marvellously. The only failure was that we were at the time in a cost-plus industrial relations circumstance where the cost was far higher than it should have been. But the idea was right, and it took us to being, as I say, the sixth most energy-developed country in the world. But we didn't keep going. And we didn't keep on moving enough creating it, because electricity is a critical essential, and we're a lucky country.
You think you want to take full advantage of it?
Precisely. Every time you want to build a dam, they're all shouting, no, you can't do this, you can't do this. And until the lights go off, and all of a sudden it's the politician's fault. Well, let's present the messaging better so that people understand that one of the most important things to do with life, and particularly a country with New Zealand's climate, is electricity.
Yeah, back to kerosene lamps.
Well, you know, I've come to the end. I mean, there have been times when I made sure we had plenty of spare candles, because when push comes to shove and everything goes off,
yeah.
three or four candles in the room will keep the room warm enough. If you're
going to do a great deal on the street, I'm going to stock up. all right, let's get on to what you've been doing. Two major speeches at the beginning of the month, one on China, one on our sort of place in the world with allies, friends, and geopolitical issues and conflicts. You've been around a while. What is your assessment of our place in the state of the world as it is, just quickly before we talk about some of the more specific things?
Our place is that small states matter. It's been a serious part and theme of my speeches, because around the world there are scores and scores of countries that think like us, and our job is to make sure that our voice matters and work with them to ensure that the outcomes for small countries are sound, good, and they are not just shoved aside by big power geostrategic politics and strategies. And that's the purpose of it. Our voice does matter. And in many ways, you know, I wouldn't have been able to go to New York and ring up the head of the United Nations and say, I want to see you. And he said, yes, I will. So we went across to tell him, you know, that this organization, often doubted, called the United Nations, is our collective responsibility, and we've got to get it right. So we had a marvelous, you know, 45-minute conversation about those sorts of things. And we're out there working as hard as we can around the area of the Pacific in particular, but wider into Asia as well, to ensure that our voice is back.
Oh, back. What does that mean?
Well, that we're re-engaged with the intensity that we should be re-engaged, because we live in a world where our whole export future is dependent upon all our connections, and we haven't been maintaining them, in my view, in the way we should have.
We're in a bit of a difficult position where we have to choose, aren't we? On one hand, we've got a huge trading partner that can make life difficult, and you've got an ally, and some of their behavior lately, I think it's fair to say, has been questionable. Who can we be friends with, actually?
Well, we should try and be friends with everybody. But, you know, one of the things about having an independent policy is not only the right to disagree, but it's the right to agree. And you'll find that the commentariat is making all sorts of descriptions of what that means. And every speech is trying to say with great clarity, look, we have friends with whom we disagree and we say so, and we have other friends who we disagree with and we say so as well. But then some of the times when we're aligned, we say that, so that in the end we have a voice, and hopefully that voice is heard. We're not trying to disagree with anyone, particularly not, you know, countries that are major trading partners, but in the end it's not their interests we're trying to promote, naturally, it's ours.
What about our interests when it comes to NATO? Some would say we've been drifting towards it. Others would say it's a headlong rush, and that was following, I think, initially Jacinda Ardern at the NATO conference in Madrid in 2022, and then Vilnius the year later. We're not even in Europe. And here's the other thing. I want to get an answer from you on this. Is Russia really the threat it's being made out to be? Because if you look into the finer detail of that, you can see kind of how that came about, yet it's being painted as, you know, if we get through Ukraine, it's the whole of Europe. Do you really believe that?
Look, they're a Security Council member. They're a critical member that has just invaded another country. I believe that because I've seen it and I'm watching.
But there's a reason for that.
Well, what would the reason be when they signed a commitment to support Ukraine? And this was post-1990, but they signed agreements to support this country. And the question is, well, why aren't you keeping your word? I can show you the agreements. On those agreements, the Ukrainians agreed to denuclearize. And what an advance that was in the circumstances of that world. And here now, having done that, all those things, they have been invaded.
But what about the area of Ukraine? It's a Russian, fundamentally Russia anyway, isn't it? The West side, maybe not so much, that were basically, there was a civil war going there. I think 40,000 or more killed. Anyway, we go through all of that, but it's easy to demonize and people believe it really easily. I was just wondering what you thought about, you know, that.
Well, I don't have to. All I have to do is go through Putin's speeches and other leaders' speeches since 1990 and the fall of the Soviet Union. And if you follow all those speeches, there is a consistency that has been broken.
Okay. Gaza, Israel. I think you're in favor of a ceasefire, obviously. The country, I'm sure, is on the whole, yeah. Though it's a very polarizing issue. But you're not willing to sort of go to Palestinian state. Wouldn't that solve it, actually, Palestinian state?
Look, this is not a case of if but when. But the first thing that people have got to do is take a practical lens to it. We have the catastrophe of Gaza, which we want fixed now.
It's rubble.
And out of left field, has come this, well, let's give them statehood now. And the question is, will you show me the three critical parts of statehood that are ready now? And they're not. And so we're not.
Well, to even obviously start the process, I guess, so people can see that.
I agree with all that. I agree with all starting the process. But let's not pretend that something exists which does not. And, you know, I've talked to the Egyptian foreign minister. I've talked to the Islamic Council. I've raised those issues and said, I know what your aspiration is, but you're asking us to say something is a fact when it's not. And it, you know, structurally and in terms of the building blocks to make a nation, that this has not happened. And so let's get rid of the darn catastrophe that's going on, stop it, and then look to this long-term thing, and we will be on your side. We want a two-state solution. And that's the only way we've got going forward. Now, across party politics and across the country, all over the world, we've all been there for a two-state solution. And now we're saying, for goodness sake, it's got to happen. And we want it to happen with speed. But we cannot afford to have that humanitarian crisis going on, not being the main part of our focus. Keep your eye on the problem, so to speak. The other one, we know, is a matter of when. But fix this now. That means, in the end, we'll only get peace when Israel and Palestine agree there's going to have to be a peace.
Gotcha. On this AUKUS setup, there's quite a few components to that. We know the Aussies and the submarines. There's even, I think, quantum computing in there. Am I right, Winston?
Well, you know, when we talk about AUKUS Pillar 2, it's September 2021. Jacinda Ardern's the Prime Minister, and she has got all her cabinet ministers working on this idea that came to them and had a paper prepared in October 2021. That's 3 years ago, and they started work on it all the way to the last election. We inherited it, carried on the work, and all of a sudden they're shouting from the rooftops, oh, you guys are doing this, this, and this. And my question to them is, show me one piece of evidence that we're doing anything like the deal at all, apart from carry on your process. And understand that we will not be part of anything unless, first of all, we've been invited to be part of it, and we have not been yet. And B, having been invited first, that we agree to be part of it. None of that's happened. So they're way ahead of themselves, making all sorts of statements. But my real challenge to those critics of mine on this matter is, so what did you say in September, October 2021, all of 2022 and all the way to 2023 on Election Day? You didn't say not a mutter, not a murmur, not a syllable, not a sound. Then all of a sudden, you're out of the woodwork. If you can't answer that question, pray tell me why you're talking now.
Okay, you've been around the traps just recently. What is the attitude to us?
Well, on this matter,
And generally,
generally, the thing is that we would not be invited to start the conversation with if they didn't see that there's a chance for on scientific matters for massive advancements. And this is that AUKUS Pillar 2 is a technology matter. It's not a military agreement. That's as clear as daylight. It was as clear as daylight in September of 2021, and it's still the same situation. So we were saying, why are these people misadvising the public? And if they were consistent, they would have said to Jacinda Ardern and then Hipkins, hey, what's going on here? But they didn't say a word.
Okay, and generally, you know, you meet a foreign minister, how aware are they?
Well, you know,
they?
This is something that is clear to me in 2024, that the world is a very different place. And we've not told the public what should be obvious to them, but the world has changed dramatically. We were all talking about trade liberalisation in the 1990s. We're all talking about the growth of democracy. We are faced now with a world where their countries are anti-trade, anti-liberalisation, so to speak, and where democracies are being threatened. We need to catch up and ensure that our place in the world is contributing to a far better outcome than is prospected by doing nothing. And we are wanting to peacefully work with countries to reprioritise the interests of small countries. Small countries matter, and so does diplomacy.
Okay, just one more thing on that. Matt Robson says in reaction to those speeches, you're signing us up to the individually tailored partnership with NATO handed to him to you by U.S. Secretary of State Blinken. We stayed out of the illegal war in Iraq. Now we're headed for further Iraqs, which is the U.S.'s specialty.
This is amazing, because who was one of the first people who argued back then not to be involved in Iraq? I was. I was there a long time before Helen Clark or any of the other people, in terms of being the Deputy Prime Minister in 1996, but in a caucus in 1990, when the first war happened. Remember? Bush Sr. is in there.
Yeah.
And the first one happened. And guess who said, don't get engaged in that? It's recorded that I said, don't get engaged in that. So, Mr. Robson, do some research before you make those judgments.
The plane didn't break down? Itzy or whatever they call it.
Well, look, it doesn't matter if it does. It does matter if it does, because we're not keeping up with our technology. But no, the plane for the Prime Minister's last trip to three countries in Asia didn't break down. But we know that we've got to buy forward modern equipment. Look, all these other countries are doing that, small countries, like Croatia, a new democracy, 3.5 million people, 2 million less than New Zealand, so to speak. And yet they're engaged in 82 countries. That's how clear they see the world. And we have been arguing that we punch above our weight, which is not true, because we haven't put the effort in, and we'll pay a price if we don't. But it's very acutely aware of, in our terms of looking at the present circumstance, that our Blue Continent neighbourhood, where all our neighbours are out there, needs a friend, needs a go-to partner, and that partner should be New Zealand, because we seriously understand the issues. And the other countries starting to say, from India to Indonesia, they want to talk to us about the Pacific, because they realise we've got a certain expertise born of decades of working there. So all those things, they're the bright side of things, I suppose.
And are we taking more seriously if our military is like strong and sort of pumped?
Well, look,
I got no problem with that, by the way.
No one wants to be engaged in a war. But the surest way to attract the war is to have no defence. This is, sadly, the world we live in. And other countries are picking that up big time. What they might say to you in private is different to what they're saying in public, but they are concerned about instability. The China Seas, for example, are a thoroughfare in which our economy totally depends for its survival. And under the law of the sea, it is what it should be, but China is challenging that. We know it every day. They're making statements every day. And it's against the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which they should have been a partner to and should be observing. We're just making the simple point, not just on the law itself, but on the long-term national interests of New Zealand. And now we're a country that depends upon supply lines. And we're an export-dependent nation more than most. And we also dependent upon supply lines going the other way. These are things that are fundamental. And we can't, you know, put her head down a hole, for example, and like an ostrich, and try and ignore it.
Okay, couple of quick fire last ones. Thank you for hanging in. Okay, so a bit of a slip in the polls for New Zealand First. Nothing too major in its early on, but a lot was made of it. do you feel like there's been any slip in support? And what do you make of the reporting of that, just quickly? And I've got one more after that.
It was atrocious. Within 3 days, one poll had us just under five, and one had us two had us on six or more. They didn't go for the poll that ticks or more. They went straight for the one that's under five, and then starts shouting out at the one person in one party that knows the polls are chaff. I can give you elections. It's 2002. The campaign starts. It's only 1 month campaign. We're on 1.8. When it was over in 1 month, we're on 10.8. You see what I think of polls?
Yeah, okay.
And in the last election, they were shouting out, rule them out, all the way to election day. And then the day after, demanding of me, what are you going to do? The very same media that did that for eight long weeks in the campaign wouldn't even come to our meetings.
Last question to finish on. There's been a bit of chatter out there. You might not have heard it or whatever, but, you know, it felt like things were slowing up. There's a lot of expectation from that coalition agreement, and I guess everyone gets it that it's not just that easy. But it seemed like things were sort of quietening down and slowing down. But then there's been therapeutic products repeal. There's been you, thankfully, again, thank you for receiving the people's terms at Parliament. Shane Jones, which is you guys, has been strident on energy in Parliament. And we've seen what happened last week with the cold snap. So things happen in fits and starts, do they?
No, that's planned. And look, we've not been going 6 months, but the therapeutic products things being repealed was announced in Parliament.
Yeah.
The inquiry into COVID, that turnaround has been hastened seriously with the conversation we've got at this point in time. And then, for example, on, you know, single-sex bathrooms and what have you, we've announced today a private member's bill on that matter, and we're going to see who salutes it, because they've done it in the UK, they've done it in other countries. We just want people to be safe. It's not anti-anybody, but someone who walks into a woman's bathroom is entitled to be only accompanied by women or girls, not by somebody else who should not be there. And one person should not be there, wants a unisex, different toilet. Fine, we'll do that. But we're not going to, and it's hideous, that women's safety in 2024 has to be done by an act of parliament now.
Oh, and crime. There's been a couple of heavy-duty crime occurrences.
There have been, but look, we're on our way to getting the extra resources, extra police, and we're going to get 800 new prison beds. Now, that was a bit confusing this week. All they'll do is walk in and say, that's how many is going to be, and we're going to build more as well. Now, that's what the outcome is. And I say again, we've barely been there 6 months.
Okay. Hey, thanks for making some time. Nice to have you back.
And no, thank you very much.
We'll talk again soon, hopefully.
And thank you. Good luck to your organization's success.
Reboot.
Well, as Phil Collins used to sing, you got to hear both sides of the story.
Yeah, well, we try, and people like that, and they came in and supported us.
That's
watch
wonderful.
Out, everybody. Watch out. Winston Peters, thank you again.
Thank you very much. Cheers, then.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.